Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The total number of homicides in Columbus last year was 84. And here are just some of the names of those who lost their lives.
Terrell Moon, Autumn Ward, Tremaine Russell, Frederick Taylor, Gary Tyler Lyon.
The groups on the ground, from mothers whose children have been murdered to police officers to juvenile judges, say their efforts day in and day out are working. They point to Operation Under Triple Digits as a promising starting point. But a double homicide at the end of 2025 put crime back in the local and national headlines. Joining us now to catch up on the latest news is WOSU reporter George Shilcock, who has been following the Tepe murder case and also covering the Operation Under Triple Digits initiative. Welcome back to All Sides, George.
Hey, Amy.
Let's start with the Tepe murder case. Spencer and Monique Tepe were found dead on December 30th in their Wyland Park home. And the case is probably somewhat familiar to most of our listeners, given the coverage it got nationally and locally. But let's just review some of the details. Who were this couple and what happened to them?
So Spencer and Monique Tepe, they lived in the Wineland Park area right on North 4th Street. They had two young kids. Spencer worked at a dentist office down in Athens, Ohio, making the commute there every day. And Monique, they met each other, got married, and had these two wonderful kids. And on December 30th, it was discovered in the early morning hours that they had been shot and killed in their own home.
What made this case so compelling? After all, more than 80 people were murdered last year, but none received this level of attention.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of the early details that first came out were that there was no sign of forced entry into this home. There was no weapon found, and the suspect got away initially, right? There was about like a 10-day span where they didn't have anyone in custody for this case. But it was pretty early on that both local media outlets and then national media outlets and even a lot of like influencers who do true crime stuff latched on to this case. Right. I mean, there was a lot of people in the community who recognized the Tepes and knew of them, maybe had gotten dental care from Spencer down in Athens or even locally. And this sort of ballooned and snowballed down the road into a like, hey, this is a really weird murder case. And people sort of latched onto that.
Well, and a part of what they latched onto was the fact that the two of them were killed, but the children were left in the home unharmed, too.
Exactly. Yeah. When police responded, they found the two kids unharmed, but of course, the two parents dead.
Yeah. Both kids under the age of five. So that was a part of it. But then there's also this issue of they were an attractive white couple, and there has been a lot of talk, both online and in the public, about the compelling nature of the case. Is it because of them, what they look like, as opposed to someone else? What are your thoughts on that?
Of course, not to minimize this murder. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. It's terrible. And like this seemed like a very happy couple, and they had these two wonderful kids. But there were over 80 other homicides in the city of Columbus last year. And nearly all of them didn't get this level of media attention. You didn't have Fox News, CNN. Like I saw CNN give an update on this yesterday on the TV in our newsroom, and they didn't get nearly this much media attention, but that's still 80 or so other lives that were lost last year in Columbus.
So the police in this case, one thing that has come into question is the police did initially do a well check because Spencer Tepe's place of business called. They were worried when he didn't show up at work, but the officer went to the wrong address. Do we know what happened there?
I hope that the Columbus police will explain a little bit more about that. They're holding a press conference today at 11. But yeah, the officer initially went to the wrong address, knocked on the front door, knocked on the back door, and left. And it wasn't until his place of business called and asked for a welfare check. When he didn't show up, that they went to the correct address and then found.
They called again, yes. Right? So this was mm-hmm. There was like a second or third call. You can hear the 911 tapes where the 911 officer is like, people keep calling about this. We sent someone. Like, she sounds confused, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so just about 50 minutes from now, the Columbus police are doing an update on this case, so we'll know more. So stay with WOSU News later today for what is updated in that. But just to talk about what happened then, the vibe from police and the neighborhood was that there was a serial killer on the loose. There was 10 days. There was no arrest. But then now we find out that Monique Tepe's ex-husband, Michael McGee. Michael McKee. From Rockford, Illinois, a vascular surgeon. He has been charged with 2 counts of murder. Tell me a little bit more about them finding Michael McKee.
Yeah, so initially police released to the public a security camera footage from like a back alley in the area that showed a person in a dark hoodie-esque clothing, like walking through there. They said this was their suspect. Then it came out on, I believe it was Saturday, right? Mm-hmm. That they had caught a suspect, that they had arrested Michael McKee from Chicago, but they arrested him in Winnebago County in Rockford. So they say that essentially what happened was they identified that his car was in the area that day, and then they tracked it back to Illinois. And that's one reason through like neighborhood security cameras that's how they sort of connected McKee to this. Mm-hmm.
And he's going to return to Ohio to face charges, but it isn't entirely clear when exactly. He was supposed to be transported to Franklin County on Monday, but an order signed yesterday by an Illinois judge says that it's now set for Friday. So I guess maybe at this press conference we'll get an update on when he's coming back here.
Yeah, I expect so. These I don't cover extradition hearings very often, but it does seem like that all the parties seem okay with him being transferred back here. Like even his own Mr. McKee's public defender said that he wants to come back to Columbus and plead not guilty, like he did so over in Illinois.
All right. So we'll get an update. Stay with WOSU News. Listen to All Things Considered later today with Debbie Holmes. And I'm sure you'll hear from George Shilcock about what happens at this 11 o'clock press conference. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the Tepe murders and Columbus's overall homicide rate for the last year, which was far less than previous years. Our guest is WOSU News reporter George Shilcock. I wanted to get into that idea of the homicide rate being lower than it had been in a number of years. So on December 17th, city police, community activists, faith leaders, they all gathered to mark that notable milestone, fewer than 100 murders. It was 81 at the time of the press conference. It was 84 by the end of the year. So this marks a reduction of nearly about 40 murders. You covered that press conference. What were some things that stuck out to you?
I think one of the big, we heard a bit of audio at the start of the show of them reading off the names. They went through all, at the time, 81 homicide victims from the year, read their names aloud. It wasn't, they weren't celebrating, right? This wasn't a celebration. This was them saying, hey, we've been working toward this goal. There's still a lot more to do. I can't count the number of people that got up there and spoke and said that, hey, like our goal is to get it even lower, if not to zero. Mm-hmm. Like the work doesn't stop here. And that was a big message they put forward, but then also recognizing that, hey, they think what this community grassroots level organization, Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children, they think what they're doing is having an impact. And that is, it is driving down homicide numbers.
And they had this initiative over the past couple of years called Operation Under Triple Digits, right? So the idea is to get the murder rate under 100, which they did. Mm-hmm. So I guess 84 murders is still not, you know, a huge success, but yeah.
But it's still remarkable. I mean, I have the homicide numbers in front of me as of December 29th, 2024. Like the year ended with 84. The year before that, it was over 120. The year before that, over 140. Going back to 2021, it was over 200 homicides that year. It was a record for Columbus. And we hadn't seen something this low since over a decade, at least. So it was a remarkable thing to see that like we were able to drop so low in just 4 years after that record year.
And when they were talking about this operation under triple digits, you mentioned some of the organizations all working together. What are some things that they said helped have there be less homicides?
They attributed a lot to this coalition that they built, like getting to work with police and having police be willing to work with the community, talk with the community, and learn about what could be done better, right? Mm-hmm. And then faith leaders and stuff like that, not just police, but like the other law enforcement at the city, like the city attorney's office and such. So they really credited it as a whole community like thing.
And the homicide unit had an 85.2% solve rate for last year. I don't know how that compares with previous years, but that seems like a B. If you were grading on like an A through F grading system, an 85%, that's a B. That sounds good. How does solving crime deter crime?
That's a great question for police. I will say that tracks, if not at a little bit higher than previous year's solve rates. And you have to also account for the fact that some of these happen toward the end of the year and they would still be investigating some of those.
Well, like
the
Tepe
murder.
If they solved the Tepe murder case, that solve rate would go in January or whatever.
Yeah. The Tepe murder happened late December and it didn't get solved until early January. So that wouldn't be in the solve rate at that time. And there were probably a few others that happened toward the end of the year that they had to carry over. Mm-hmm.
They also said that Columbus police seized nearly 1,000 firearms. That's 100 more than last year. Do you feel like maybe does that contribute to things, too? I don't know. 1,000 guns is a lot of guns, but I don't know how many guns are out there.
In terms of guns being seized, like, you know, in this country, we have guns for sale in a lot of different places. There are a lot of lax gun laws in Ohio. But I think a bigger thing to point to isn't the amount of guns seized. It's this. They're working more toward intensifying how they solve violent crime. Mm-hmm. Like one thing that they co-piloted in the Milo Grogan neighborhood and that the city says they want to expand citywide is this treating non-fatal shootings as if they were a fatal shooting, investigating them with the same rigor and stuff like that. That's like the type of words they used. And it's if they expand that, they seem really confident that level of rigor involving these like non-fatal shootings can eventually lead to, you know, less violence happening.
And just finally, the domestic violence death rate continues to be an area of concern. Did they talk about that in efforts to bring those numbers down?
Yeah, it's been since even before this year. Mm-hmm. Domestic violence, homicides, felonious assaults have been pretty high, and the city has made an effort to really kind of message to the community, tamp down on domestic violence. I think like most cities in this country, they're still working for a workable solution towards getting there. But that is a big chunk of homicides. Like as of December 29th, I see that 19 of those were domestic violence and then 11 of those were domestic related of the 81 reported by that time. Mm-hmm. So it's a big chunk. That's not insignificant. You know, it's not over 50% of the homicides, but that's still a big chunk. Mm-hmm.
We have been talking about the number of murders in Columbus in 2025. The number was under 100 for the first time in years. And we've been talking about it with WOSU News reporter George Shilcock. Thank you for your time today, George.
Yeah, thank you, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about Operation Under Triple Digits with the founder and CEO of Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The United States once saw part of its mission as a nation builder, peacekeeper, and defender of democracy. The Trump administration, however, plans to exit over 60 international organizations. Once considered the arsenal of democracy and the leader of the free world, we're talking about how this withdrawal from international organizations is changing the United States' image on the world stage. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The total number of homicides last year was 84. It represents the first time in years the number dipped below 100. The groups on the ground, from mothers whose children have been murdered to police officers to juvenile judges, say their efforts day in and day out are working. They point to Operation Under Triple Digits as a promising starting point. But there is more work to be done, and they can't do it alone. Joining us now is Melissa Thomas St. Clair, founder of Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children. She formed the group in 2020. Welcome to All Sides, Melissa.
Hi, everyone. How are you today?
So Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children has been cited as a key player in this Operation Under Triple Digits, along with other groups. What started the idea of the Under Triple Digits initiative?
Well, on November 13, 2023, I was hosting a live conversation with the community members, as I do so often on our Facebook Live, and we were doing a data dive, and we went probably as far back to 2009. We were just kept going down this kind of rabbit hole of Columbus, Ohio data, and we started to notice, wow, how many years it had been since we were under triple digits. You know, most of mothers in this organization has lost their children in from 2020 and newer. So we said, well, wouldn't it be amazing if we could be under 100 homicides? I think the first time we were under since 2014. Mm-hmm. So in that conversation, we were like, oh my gosh, it would be great to be under 100. And the name was born and the initiative was born. And on that live that day, I just started calling out organizations and agencies and the Columbus Division of Police to partner with us in this stakeholder coalition we have now. And the Columbus Division of Police were the first to jump on and say, you know what? We're on board. We love what this can do with our partnership and to take a deeper dive in our partnership. So January of 2024, it was launched and it took a lot of belief, a lot of hope and a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything specific you think was the difference maker? Was it Columbus Police getting on board? Because you got under the triple digits, not just by one or two, but by many.
Well, I think it was multifactored. So it was actually already happening. I don't want to make it seem as if this work wasn't already in place. And I would say even from 2021 and 2022, when we hit those historic years of homicides, I think the community got tired. I think they were ready for a change, which shifted their heart posture. I think Columbus Division of Police shifted their way of working, where it went from obvious enforcement, but to also community engagement. I think that built a trust and a bridge where community now were discussing and communicating, which gave tips, which led to arrests, which led to solvability. And you know, when you have a higher solve rate, homicides go down because offenders now start to see, whoa, this is not the OK Corral and it's not anarchy and we're going to get caught and less people want to be held accountable. So they've been making different decisions.
Melissa, you lost your son, Anthony, to murder in 2013. He was 22 years old. An unimaginable loss. And I'm so sorry. My condolences.
Thank you.
But from grief to action. How did you get there? How did you go from grief to action?
So I'm a 28-year veteran educator with Columbus City Schools. And when Anthony was murdered in 2013 at 22 years old, I already started to instantly use his testimony and his story to help other students that I was coming in contact on a daily basis. Because I did not only lose my son, I was losing students along this 28-year journey. So in a smaller scale, I was using his testimony because of my work in education. But it was the lightning in the bottle moment. It was August 12, 2020, when a 2-year-old was murdered by his 14-year-old uncle. That 14-year-old uncle was one of my students. And that 2-year-old was murdered right around the corner from where I educate. So one small Facebook post, I've got to do more, led to my co-founder, who was a former student, Carla Harris, saying the same exact thing at the same time. So together, we just said, well, we need to do more. And we set out to do something very small scale, bring awareness. She's not lost children, but she's lost friends and family. But we were going to sit on a corner and just talk our principles, peace, positivity, prayer, and protection. And we didn't realize that that was almost like a call to action to all those who have been affected by violence, and the amount of people who found peace within this movement on the onset was just incredible. So we noticed that this was bigger than us, and it was bigger than just Anthony, and that families needed a sacred place to be healed, to have healing space, but also to use their pain for purpose. But the big point in was my husband is a civilian at the police department. And this before Chief Elaine Bryant came and First Assistant Chief Potts. This is the old regime. So he was a civilian and he was able to get the partnership and have the police come out. And this was the height of George Floyd. This was the height of when everyone was downtown and it was us as community against police. And we noticed that that just wasn't working. And we were losing vast amount of people in our community because of that. And so the alignment with the police happened instantaneously. And we were the first organization to hand our olive branch. And we were really not welcome for that by other community members. But we knew that needed to work. And we knew we needed to stand on that. And we did. And it has been a game changer for community safety.
The 84 people who died by violence in 2025, it was from an infant to the elderly. Each one was someone who was loved, who will be missed, who had a story to tell. At the beginning of the show, I played audio of the names of some of the names of the homicide victims from last year being read at a December press conference as a way of remembering each individual. They read the names. So at the time when they read the names, it was 81. The year ended with 84, according to police records. But do you feel like saying the names and act like that, remembering people, what kind of impact does that have?
When you have an initiative that says under triple digits, where you're saying under 100, and you kind of want to have a momentous, like, honoring of our, you know, moving forward, we didn't want to slight, especially as survivors ourselves, the families who, even though we're under, even though that's something that we can say, okay, we're moving in a right trajectory, we wanted to ensure that these families understood this movement is also for them, that their lives are not going to go in vain, that we are going to fight so that their purpose can be had in saving other lives. So we wanted to ensure the families knew we're not celebrating, we're honoring, and we're also fighting, so that they don't go in vain.
Two of the murders from 2025 came at the very end of the year, December 30th, a double homicide, husband and wife, Spencer and Monique Tepe. I wondered your thoughts on all of the national and local attention this crime received, because it was a lot of attention. What did you think about this attention of this Columbus crime?
And I'm glad you said that, because I just spoke about this yesterday on a live with my community. And I understand twofold, because I've been really hearing the community, and some are understanding, you know, the variables within this double homicide is not, it's rare. So it's going to garner national attention. It's going to garner, you know, some of those media outlets that are just for the shock value or, you know, the likes and clicks. But there are media outlets out there that really want to push the homicides out in order to gain information so that somebody can be held accountable. But then you have community members who wish that that could happen for their loved one, mm-hmm. especially those who are still seeking justice, and they want that national attention to have that needle in a haystack found for them. So it is a twofold feeling for me. I understand why it happened, because it is so rare. You have a mother and a father. You have unforced entry. You have two live children, a young baby and a young child. This is something that is really sensational in the worst way. So to those families who also lost a loved one, you're no different. That's somebody that was so deeply important to you. And it is important then for them to step out and tell their story like we all do.
I mean, but it's not lost on someone. You know, they were an attractive white couple, a dentist. I mean, you mentioned the little kids, the pictures of them. Do you feel like it does downplay a little bit the other 82 homicide victims in 2025?
I don't think it downplays the other victims. I think what happened was, and I know that a lot of times when you have an affluent couple who may be, you know, of a race of, you know, the majority, that you would think that that's the reason why that they were garnering so much attention. But I think it's so much more than that. I think it's because of all the other variables that were involved in this case. I mean, if you think that you're going to have two living children under the age of five in this home alive and their parents are murdered, that's a movie in itself, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's something you would see, if nothing else, on Lifetime. So, no, I don't think other parents, other families should feel slighted. I think that they should feel motivated to use platforms that are ready to hear their stories, willing to hear their stories, and just be bold enough in their own truth to seek justice.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the decrease in homicides in Columbus last year and Operation Under Triple Digits with Melissa Thomas St. Clair with Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children. I do want to say we did invite the Columbus Division of Police to take part in today's show, but a police spokesperson said that no one was available to join. Melissa, I wanted you to assess the police efforts in bringing down these numbers. You mentioned it earlier. You said you've been working with them. How have the police been doing in bringing down these numbers?
Well, I will tell you, the number one transition and transformation that I've seen as a community member is that they have really done a phenomenal job with their engagement efforts. In past before, I don't think community really, I know that the Columbus Division of Police have always, in some way, smaller scale, or, you know, a scale in which I was unaware of, been involved with the community. But in this level, they have made a concerted effort to really engage the community in multiple ways. It's not just coming out to a community, setting up a table, trying to recruit for the Columbus Division of Police. They have a beyond enforcement where they are really engaging the youth. And these are at-risk youth, bringing them into a multi-week unit in which they are able to go to the coroner's office. They've taken them to the prison, London Prison. They have had other 501c3 grassroots organizations really pour into them. Then you have where you've got Trunk or Treat, where you have got thousands, and I've been there, of community. And these are offenders that are coming with their families, which would have never happened. They are approachable. And these are from executive to police patrol officers. You're starting to know who your sergeants are. You're starting to know who your lieutenants are. We're learning about zones. We're really being educated on how the force operates. And that allows us to build the trust within them and also work alongside to bring the homicides down.
Yeah, and I also wanted to mention that police seized 1,000 firearms over the past year. That's 100 more than last year. And at that press conference that I mentioned earlier, Columbus police highlighted the hard work of your group to interrupt violence and form long-lasting partnerships with community members and Columbus youth. How did you forge these relationships, and what do you think they've meant?
Well, it's priceless. I will say this did start in 2021, and this was before Chief Elaine Bryant and First Assistant Chief Potts even came from Detroit. This actually started because then Lieutenant McFadden, I think she was promoted to commander, but then Lieutenant McFadden, Melissa McFadden, who's since retired, had contacted me in 2021, and she said, Melissa, I noticed on your Facebook so many mothers don't understand the process of, you know, arrests to accountability in the judicial system. I'd love to create an opportunity for your group to come in and speak to executive levels. It was Commander Strasbaugh at the time, and I think Chief Mike was there at the time. But we had what was called our first quarterly meeting. It was February of 2021. We were down at headquarters, And Strasbourg brought in executive level police officials and then also people from the judicial system, the prosecuting. We learned so much. And it was such a phenomenal experience. We have kept those quarterly meetings every quarter from February 2021 to current. And they've evolved. They've evolved with the change of hand of command staff. And it's something that has really not only educated us, but brought us together as family.
Democratic Representative Dontavius Gerrels, he represents the Columbus area. He was at that same press conference, and he said this is not a victory lap by talking about getting under the number 100. He's advocating for sensible gun laws. He says that the Republicans need to, quote, buy in to reduce firearm deaths. How are lobbying efforts going at the State House? I know you're involved.
So, no, I'm not involved with lobbying efforts. We leave that to our partner organization, Moms Demand Action. We don't have enough verse education in that field. So that is something we look forward to growing in, however. But we are grassroots on the ground level. And when we do have some dual mothers, however, that are part of Moms Demand Action and are part of my organization. Mm. However, we do want to get more mothers on the floor at the State House to tell their story and to testify and really humanize these victims so that others who maybe, I think the misconception with Mothers of Murder Columbus Children is that we want to take firearms away. That is not the case. I will be transparent. I am a firearm owner. We want educated firearm owners to be responsible. We want to make sure you're locking your firearms up. If you look into the data, I think there were 4 or 5 accidental shootings from firearms that weren't locked up. Firearms that were in the hands of children who would make, obviously, a permanent accident. So those are where our hearts are, to tell our stories, to create responsible gun owner laws.
And just to end on, in the minute we have left, what are some additional resources that would be helpful to your organization and then just overall to the operation under triple digits so that 2026 can be an under triple digits year as well?
Well, we want to recruit, and we want to recruit on a diverse level. So we want to make sure that people who are living in our suburban areas, surrounding areas, are also involved. We want to be able to share our stories on a bigger platform. We want to be able to show up and show that we're resilient and that we are ready to save lives from the bloodshed that our children had to have. And in order to do that, we want everyone to understand we need to love each other. We need to pray with one another. We need to gather together. We need to engage with one another. But most importantly, we need to take care of each household that we live in first, heal one another, heal inside, and then branch out. Diversity is one of our best kept secrets here in Columbus. We should not have that divide us. But in fact, we need to bring that together. We're in tough times now. So now is more than ever, love one another.
We've been talking about the decrease in homicides in Columbus last year, and we've been talking about Operation Under Triple Digits with Melissa Thomas St. Clair, founder of Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Join us at undertripledigits.org.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a judge who is working with young people to reduce juvenile crime. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We've been talking this hour about crime, specifically homicides, and the multi-pronged effort to reduce the number in Columbus. Operation Under Triple Digits succeeded in its goal last year, logging nearly 40 fewer murders from the year before. The final total landed in the double digits at 84. But the overall goal is not just ending homicides, but scaling back all crime and calling on those who have a hand in making a difference, especially when it comes to youth in the criminal justice system. And that's where a new program at Franklin County Juvenile Court comes into play. Joining us now is Judge Lachelle Stroud, the lead juvenile judge for Franklin County Domestic Relations and Juvenile Court. Welcome to All Sides, Judge Stroud.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
This fall, a new program was launched. It's called the Franklin County Juvenile Felony Diversion Program. I got all the words in there.
Yes.
And this takes a restorative, non-traditional approach to justice. So tell us about the program. Why was it started? How does it work?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come in and to share. So to get right into the program, this program is unique. First, because it was launched in conjunction with the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office. Prosecutor Shayla Favor and our court had a conversation about what we could do to help with the collaborative effort for community and increasing justice, specifically in juvenile court. Mm-hmm. So we've always done diversion as a part of our court, but it's been primarily misdemeanor cases mm-hmm. versus felony cases. So it makes it unique because, one, we collaborated with an organization outside of the court, and then two, because we expanded the traditional view of diversion to include low-level felonies. So a part of our diversion program is the Community Restorative Justice Circles, which takes about a 90-day process where youth who have been charged with an offense go into a room of community members, and mm-hmm. they sit in a circle, have a conversation about, you know, what the youth was alleged to have done. The victim is invited to that circle, mm-hmm. As well as other people who choose to volunteer to be a part of it. So this program allowed low-level felony alleged offenders to be a part of that process, and then they have a conversation so that the youth can, first of all, accept accountability, have an opportunity to apologize both to the victim as well as to the community. And then they receive whatever that circle believes that they should do. So it could be community service hours. It could be paying restitution. If the victim had some type of financial loss, they talk through all of those things to have a community conversation. So this felony diversion program extended that so that low-level felonies could have the opportunity to do the same thing that the misdemeanor offenders were able to do for many years.
Are you in the room whenever the person is meeting with their victim and they're talking about this?
So I am not, as the judge,
okay.
And the magistrate, so no judicial officer is in the room. But I have been in the room before as a volunteer many years ago. I did a similar program called Project Truancy, again, for youth who were missing school. And you bring in the community, similar to the additive, it takes a village to raise a child. That's really what this program is based on, bringing together community members so that we can have accountability, but also to find out what are the needs, what are you missing, what is it that we can do as community members to help and maybe give you a different perspective. So now as a judge, I'm not in the room, but I have been in the room before as a volunteer, which is why we encourage community members to get involved as well.
I can imagine it could get emotional. I
yes.
mean, having an offender in there with the victim, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. And so it's not mandatory that the mm-hmm. victims, but they do have the opportunity. It's completely up to them. So first, the youth is not allowed to participate in the program if the victim is not fully in consent at the onset. So then the victim is invited to be a part of the circle. And then again, it's completely their prerogative if they would like to attend. But it makes it so much more powerful. You're mm-hmm. correct. When you get to sit across from the person, hear from the person who says, I had a loss, right? It's more than I had to pay my insurance company $500. It's I get to look you in your eyes and tell you I was violated mm-hmm. and what that felt like. And then for the person who was on the other side to hear that, and to have to sit in it. We're not shying away from what you did. We're trying to make sure we have a conversation collectively to say, how can we move forward? Mm-hmm. So it is a very powerful conversation.
And I would think, not for everyone, but for some people, being in that room, having that powerful moment, understanding the impact of what you did, hopefully will stop it from happening again.
Absolutely. That is the goal, right? Mm-hmm. So that as you accept responsibility, as you accept accountability, to look at everyone who's in the room, right? To know that not only did I let myself down and my own family down because I'm taking away time. Mm-hmm. My parents maybe had to take off of work for sure to go to court, mm-hmm. and maybe even to come to the circle. So yes, I let people down, and let me sit in that, and then let me take accountability and responsibility and say, how can I move forward? And this is a feeling that I don't want to have happen again. But even more powerful than that, I get to look around and see all of these people who really do care about me as a person and who I have a community that I'm responsible to.
So care about you as a person beyond just your crime.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. This is more than what you did. Mm-hmm. This is about who you are and how do we get here and how can we take this opportunity to go in a different direction.
We started the show talking about the city's homicide rate and how the community collaborated and succeeded in bringing that number under 100, right?
Yes.
A similar collaboration is happening on the court side of things. There's a felony diversion program, for example, different groups coming together for solutions. So we're not talking about homicides or violent crimes mm-hmm. with this program that you're talking about because you said it's low-level felonies. But what kind of who's eligible to take part? Like, to tell me, I don't know what a low-level felony is.
Okay.
I guess.
Yes, uh-huh. yeah. I understand. And thank you for mm-hmm. asking that because sometimes, right, when we're in court, mm-hmm. we're used to all of the acronyms and everything. So a low-level felony would be so felonies range from felony ones, which is the highest level, which your homicides would be in mm-hmm. felony ones, and down to felony five. So when we say low-level, we're talking about a felony four or felony five.
So a low-level is a higher number, but continue.
Yes, yeah. I know. Right. That is correct. So we could be talking about what we call receiving stolen property. So stolen cars, things being taken out of those cars, theft. So it's too high. It's over $1,000. So it's not a misdemeanor, but it is a low level felony. So, yes, felony fours and fives are the low level felonies that we're talking about, because the reason why it was important to expand is because what we found was that when these youth were going through our normal court process, a lot of the same things that the restorative justice circles recommend for the misdemeanors is what was happening to these youth, mm-hmm. but oftentimes a year and a half later. Mm. So this gives us an opportunity to intervene at a sooner point so that you're not coming to court month after month during that year or year and a half to have the same outcome that a youth who had a misdemeanor had. So maybe we can intervene and have a conversation.
And juvenile is under 18. I thought
Correct.
We should establish that. Okay.
Correct. Yes.
How would you characterize juvenile crime in Franklin County? Is it a growing problem? You mentioned theft. People are mm-hmm. There's always this real or perceived gang
yes.
activity situation. What is most juvenile crime?
So what I will say first when we talk about ages is that we do have people in our court who have now turned 18 or are older. But to be in juvenile court, it has to be alleged that you committed the offense when you were under the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So it may not be disposed of before you turn mm-hmm. 18. We still have jurisdiction. And the orders that we make, we have jurisdiction over individuals up until the age of 21. So I'd like to make that distinction as well. We do mm-hmm. handle people once they're over 18 years of age. And under juvenile law, it's called juvenile delinquency. So it would be a crime if you were 18 years of age or older. And this is, it's all the same offenses that adults are charged with as crimes. So anything that an adult can be charged with, whether it is the theft, receiving stolen property, burglary, robbery, we handle all of those mm-hmm. things in juvenile court if someone was alleged to have committed that offense before they turned 18. We also handle what we call status offenses, things that are not considered crimes, but because you're under the age of 18, that you can come into our court, like running away from home or mm-hmm. not going to school, right? No mm-hmm. one over 18 is being charged with that, but those offenses come into juvenile court. court, because there's things that as a community under the law, we say we want to have people be held accountable for. When you talk about the numbers and what does it look like, similar to the under triple digits, and I'll say I am proud to have been at the stakeholder convening since the beginning of the under triple digits initiative, all the way through the press conference in December, so that we can talk about the progress that's been made with that program over the last 2 years. Similar to them seeing a decrease, we have seen a decrease in juvenile delinquencies. We look at trends, we're data driven. So we can say with confidence that over the last 10 years here in Franklin County, our quarters countywide, that here in Franklin County, we've seen a decrease in juvenile delinquencies by 25%. So when we look back, we've seen a decrease in the filings, which is something that we as a community are able to celebrate, that we can do two things at once. We can have more diversion and increase our diversion programs, and also still say we have a very safe community to where we've seen a decrease over time. Also similar to what you've mentioned in the prior segments, we've seen an increase in domestic violence, unfortunately, similar to what the city of Columbus is representing to you, that over that same 10-year period, we've seen those numbers go up higher, which is why we as a court are working on how can we, that's why we look at the numbers, how can we better serve the families who are in our court based on who we know is showing up.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a new pilot program, the Juvenile Felony Diversion Program, with Judge Lachelle Stroud, lead juvenile judge for Franklin County Domestic Relations and Juvenile Court. The court also runs other diversion programs. Tell me about the Community Restorative Circles program.
So the Community Restorative Circles program is the program that, in large part, the Felony Diversion Program utilizes. So what we did was expand that Community Restorative Circle to say now, instead of including only misdemeanors, those low-level felonies are being referred to that program. So those are the circles where we invite members of the community. They volunteer. The volunteers go through a training process before they ever sit in on a circle so that they're prepared when the family come in.
Okay, so it's the same same program, two names.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Where we expanded it to include the felonies.
Oh, I understand. Okay, so let's talk about what happens at the end of the circle. So what kind of, do some of them end up serving time? Do they end up paying a fine? Like, what happens?
So we are a Detention Alternatives Initiative Court, JDAI, which is a nationwide program through the Annie E. Casey Foundation. I say that to say we only want in our, we call it an intervention center, but in our detention center, only youth who need to be there. So youth who are a threat to public safety are the only people who we want to be detained, because we understand the impact of what it does for someone, especially at a young age before your brain is fully developed, to be incarcerated. So the youth who we divert as a part of diversion, one of the recommendations would not be to go to the detention center, because that's at the opposite end of the spectrum. They would recommend different things like community service, things like an apology letter to the victim, to pay the victim if there is a need for restitution. So initially, when we started the restorative justice circles, and restitution being one of the recommendations, if the victim has had a financial loss, that would be an order at the end. The felony diversion program, we changed it to say, when we ask the victim, are you in agreement with the youth participating in this? If the victim at that time has some type of financial loss, we make it to where the victim is paid at the beginning. So before the circle date, the victim is able to be repaid what he or she is out, so that the victim is made whole going into the circle. That's a difference for the felony diversion than the way we did it before.
Wait, who is paying? The offender?
Yes, the request is for the offender. So first, these are youth.
That could take some time.
But that's another change that we made that makes this program unique. One, because we recognize these are youth and most of them do not have jobs, so we know it would be the parent, right, who's paying for it. But we have a community service restitution program where youth are able to work with community organizations who have agreed to allow our youth to come in, and they earn $10 an hour to go towards their restitution.
Oh.
But what what we did for this felony diversion program is that it's paid up front and then the youth do the work afterwards so that the victim is made whole at the beginning.
Okay. Yes. Got it. That makes sense.
Yes.
Because that would take forever.
Yes, it could, depending on how much.
Depending on how much. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. The felony diversion program started in September, so this is new.
It is.
And it's a pilot program lasting 1 year.
Yes.
Will it be renewed?
That is our hope, mm-hmm. right? If we see success with it. What I can tell you, in the short period of time that we've had 28 youth who have been referred to the program, and the majority of the youth who have completed it by now have been successful. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing success. We made it a 1 year pilot so that we can, again, look at the numbers, see how things are going. Do we need to make any adjustments? Or is it something that we should have at all? But it is very encouraging, the preliminary data that we are seeing from the program. So it is our hope that it will continue to make victims whole, that we will continue to be able to have these community conversations, see youth not return to court for anything at all. Mm-hmm. So as long as we have that success, I'm hopeful that the judges will agree to have it continue mm-hmm. if it's successful.
Well, and I know you mentioned the circle includes volunteers, but
yes.
How is it funded? I mean, it has to cost money to put this thing together.
So our budget, we already had that program for the misdemeanor program. Mm-hmm. So we have court staff, but a part of their job, duty, and responsibility is to ensure that the circles are working effectively. Mm-hmm. So we didn't spend any additional money to include low-level felonies. So we haven't paid anything extra to be able to expand the program since it's a program that's already running.
Just a bigger circle.
Correct. We're just enlarging the circle.
All right. I want to say thank you for your time today. We've been talking with Judge Lachelle Stroud, lead juvenile judge for the Franklin County Domestic Relations and Juvenile Court. Thank you so much for joining us for All Sides today.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.